And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we're in week three of being locked down. And it's, I've seen, people out walking, which our mayor said yesterday was not advised. We also closed parks and golf courses and recreational facilities. So if you haven't got it in your home or in your backyard, you're pretty much out of luck when it comes to getting out of the house. Well, we've been talking about quite a number of secrets of World War II. Now, that's a war that there's a lot of misunderstood elements. I mean, it got off to a poor start for the Allies, and nowhere was this more evident than in France during the 1940 campaign. But France was only the worst debacle. There was also a major problem in North Africa, the Balkans, and literally almost everywhere the Allies was fighting somebody, there were problems. Despite all the bad news, though, there were certain, rays of hope that said perhaps there might be an Allied victory. You know, often overlooked, fixed defenses had an important role in World War II. The many fortified positions that influenced the course of the war, none was so extensive as France's Maginot Line. Now, there was the Gustav Line in Italy, and there were numerous fortified islands in the Pacific, but far and away, the Maginot Line was the most extensive and supposedly the most impregnable. And the Maginot Line was also the most misunderstood defensive facility in popular imagination. Now, the idea for the Maginot Line actually came from the trench slaughter of World War I. After a lot of debate in the late 20s, the French began to develop an elaborate system of fortifications on their frontier with Germany. It was named after a war minister who'd lost an army at Verdun, and it was designed to prevent a direct German invasion of France by making such an attempt so prohibitively expensive in lives and time that the French would be able to husband their resources in the rear for a decisive counterstroke with mobile forces. Now, the basic concept wasn't really as absurd as it was to appear in hindsight. Among the greatest fortification experts in the world since the 17th century, the French were fully aware that their proposed new fortified zone was not impregnable. Now, even though it was called the Maginot Line, it wasn't a line per se, but it was a system of defenses that actually created what might be referred to as a demilitarized zone. And it'd be so difficult to break that it would deter a German offensive in northeastern France. Now, unable to deliver a swift, decisive blow against it, the Germans would have to give up all thought of war with France or accept a protracted war of attrition, or maybe find an alternative way to carry on the war. And French policymakers were certain that this last eventuality would be the one that the Germans would choose, specifically a German thrust into Belgium. And such an undertaking by a revitalized Germany would inevitably bring Great Britain into war on the side of France, a necessity given France's manpower inferiority against the Germans. Beginning of the war, the Germans had 100 divisions. The French had 90. The British had 10. And then there were the Russians, who had a massive army. The principal function of the Maginot Line was to channel a German offensive into Belgium, where it'd be met by motorized French army supported by British resources. And this plan had the added advantage of having the horrors of war visited upon Belgium rather than France. Now, as it was built, the Maginot Line was a wonder to behold. And in fact, the remains of it that are visible today are makes you wonder how it got overcome. It consisted of a loose belt of fortifications starting a few miles inside France. The defensive zone varied from 5 to 10 miles in depth, literally seasoned with sunken forts, redoubts, pillboxes, observation towers, tank traps, and other defensive works. And these works were designed to make maximum use of available ground, which already favored the defense, as northeastern France, that's Alsace-Lorraine, is rather mountainous, heavily forested, and occasionally even marshy. Most positions, which were all gas-tight, were mutually supporting, and all were capable of holding out independently for extended periods if necessary. In some of the more densely fortified areas, the principal works were linked together by underground railroads to permit the rapid movement of reinforcements and munitions from position to position. Now, actually, only about 87 miles of the Franco-German frontier were covered by permanent works at the extraordinary cost of 80.5 million francs per mile. That's about $20 million. I don't know why, in this time, continual calls, even over business lines, wanting you to take out health insurance. If you don't have it already, you probably have an issue. Now, as I said, it was about $20 million per mile in 1930 dollars. Quarter of a billion in today's dollars. Now, these works covered the most vulnerable areas. Less vulnerable areas, such as the 30-mile Sora Gap, were to be protected in time of war by demolitions, water lines such as the Rhine itself, and inundations covered by combat troops and field fortifications. Now, despite the enormous expenditure of over 7 billion francs, that's nearly $20 billion in today's dollars, system wasn't fully completed by 1940. But it was sufficiently completed so as to have precisely the deterrent effect for which the French had been hoping when they started the project. Now, there seems little doubt the Maginot Line was more or less impenetrable from a frontal attack, at least at a price the Germans weren't willing to pay. Certainly, German war planners proposed nothing more than demonstrations against the line in the event of war, preferring instead to go into Belgium, precisely as the French expected and hoped. French planning for the anticipated German offensive into Belgium presumed the Germans would come more or less as they had in 1914, a massive wheeling drive across northern Belgium and then southward into France. And to meet this, the French allocated the best part of their army, over 30 divisions, including virtually all their dozen motorized and light armored divisions, through their left flank. And in company with fully motorized British, they would boldly advance into Belgium in the event of a German invasion and try to meet the enemy along the Dyle River, east of Brussels, for what they hoped would be a decisive battle. Now, in their initial planning for their 1940 offensive into France, the Germans actually came up with a plan that more or less was what the French expected them to do, a holding action against the Maginot Line with a straightforward drive across the Belgian plain, taking advantage of the superior mobility and effectiveness of their 17 armored and motorized divisions. The objective was to secure as much of the country as possible in anticipation of future offensive. And although this plan met with the approval of the German General Staff, which I might point out had been outlawed by the Treaty of Versailles, but it was installed secretly by Hitler, Hitler didn't like the plan. He wanted a quick win to maintain his popularity, and the plan suggested a protracted struggle. A relatively junior German officer, Erich von Manstein, came up with a more complex, bolder, and riskier plan. Under his proposal, a portion of the army, including some armored and motorized formations supported by airborne troops, would attack directly into Belgium and Netherlands as a feint to draw Allied reserves northward. Meanwhile, the bulk of the army, the German army, would attack through the Ardennes, a ruggedly heavily forested region covering most of Luxembourg, plus adjacent portions of France and Belgium. The idea was to cut deeply through the Allied forces, creating an enormous pocket in Belgium, maybe winning the war in one grand offensive. Hitler liked this plan. It appealed to his sense of grandeur, despite the risks which were, frankly, considerable. Many years earlier, Marshal Philippe Pétain, a hero of World War I, had been asked about the possibilities of a German offensive in his very area, to which he applied, "The Ardennes are impenetrable, if adequately defended." And he was absolutely right. The Ardennes are traversed by few roads, and these are narrow and easily blocked with light forces, provided there were enough of them. On the morning of May 10, 1940, the French General Staff learned the Germans had launched their long-anticipated offensive. One officer said to the Chief of Staff, Maurice Gamelin, "So it's the Dahl plan, though?" And Gamelin looked up and said, "Well, what else can we do?" And indeed, everything went according to plan. Unfortunately, it was the German plan. At the first sign of the German offensive, the feint into Netherlands and northern Belgium, the French and British leapt forward into Belgium. Elements of the French 7th Army on the extreme left advanced something like 150 miles in the first 48 hours, one of the most impressive motor marches by a large force up to that time. By nightfall on May 12th, the Allied spearheads were well into the Netherlands and Belgium. At that same moment, the German main blow fell. Nearly a dozen armored motorized divisions emerged from the Ardennes to fall upon the second-line French forces near Sedan. The German movement had only been undetected but virtually unimpeded because the Ardennes had been hardly adequately defended. Allied strength in that region consisted of two Belgian light infantry divisions and the French cavalry, who, despite heroic efforts, only managed to slow the Germans down by a few hours. I mean, the Germans literally rolled over them. The French defenses at Sedan crumbled quickly under the extraordinary strength and violence of the German offensive. Within a day, the Germans were across the Meuse and heading west through a 50-mile gap they had torn in the French front. A few days more, and the Germans were halfway across France despite often heroic attempts to stop them. And late on May 20th, the Germans reached the English Channel near Abbeville, effectively pocketing nearly 40 British, French, and Belgian divisions. And then came Dunkirk, the German offensive southward to fall to Paris and surrender France. And through it all, the Maginot Line remained virtually unscathed. The Maginot Line had worked in the sense it had channeled the German offensive into Belgium. Despite this success, you might believe that the French might have spent their money better elsewhere. You know, fearing that a German invasion was imminent after the fall of Norway in 1940, the Swedish Army mobilized only to discover that the total available stockpile of anti-aircraft ammunition was barely sufficient to sustain a simultaneous one-minute firing by all the anti-aircraft guns on hand. And the Luftwaffe was highly effective until they ran into a bit of trouble. Now, the Royal Air Force defeated the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain, summer of 1940, largely because the radar warning systems that allowed ground controllers to effectively concentrate the outnumbered British fighters on individual groups of German bombers. As effective as this was, 69% of the British fighters sent to a specific location where the controllers thought the German bombers would be found nothing. The radars at that time were crude, and the information they provided was subject to misinterpretation or false alarms, but it was good enough to let the British defeat the Luftwaffe, which upset Hermann Göring. In an active career of only 200 days during 1941, the HMS Prince of Wales, Great Britain's newest battleship, commissioned on March 31, 1941, participated in the pursuit of the German battleship Bismarck in May. Sustained some damage in the process, carried Winston Churchill to the Atlantic Conference in Argentia Bay in Newfoundland in August, and was sunk in action by a Japanese aircraft off Malaya December 10th. So in actuality, it was only around about 9 months, but it accomplished a great deal. The best you can say about it, it was a short life, but a glorious one. What was most amazing about the German conquest of France in May of 40 was the Germans were outnumbered. They had fewer troops, fewer tanks, fewer weapons of most kinds, were superior only in their number of aircraft. But within a month, the Germans defeated the French, the Belgians, the Netherlands, and the British forces sent to the continent. Moreover, the Allies had 6 months to prepare for the battle. War was actually declared in September 1939 when the Germans invaded Poland. Now, history reports that the German invasion was in response to what was supposed to be a Polish attack on a German installation. It was actually German troops dressed in Polish army uniforms. But Hitler didn't need much provocation. The French, at that point, while the German army was in Poland, the French, the Belgians, and the Dutch mobilized on their borders with Germany. And during this period, Great Britain sent 11 divisions and hundreds of aircraft. The rapid German victory in Poland shocked the Allies. In less than 3 weeks, the Germans had smashed the Polish armed forces, and nobody expected anything that fast. I mean, the Polish armed forces, while not the best, were still good. For that reason, as well as an excess of prudence, the Allies didn't invade Western Germany in the fall of 39 when the Allies outnumbered the nearby German troops by several times. The Allies thought they'd prevail anyway when the Germans attacked. After all, they had numbers on their side. And the British were positive that they could put up a stiffer fight than the Polish had. Numbers were certainly impressive. Quite frankly, May 10th, 1940, the Allies had 140 divisions against the Germans, 122. They were almost comparable in artillery. They had more tanks, about half the machine guns the Germans had, and they had about 1,000 less planes. Now, the Allies were still thinking World War I, despite the swift German victory in Poland. Moreover, the Allied situation was somewhat more complex than what the Poles faced. Aside from the fact the Poles were outnumbered, Poland had no natural defenses and was surrounded by German territory on three sides. France had mountains in the southern half of its border with Germany. And to make that area secure, the French had built a massive line of well-armed concrete fortifications, the famed Maginot Line. In the north, there was neutral Belgium and the Netherlands. These two nations had mobilized 1 million men between them. But these troops are even less well-trained and armed than the French. World War I, the Germans had avoided the rough country in the south and had come through the flat terrain of Belgium. And the Allies expected a repeat of this in 1940. But couldn't convince the Belgians or the Dutch to informally plan for that eventuality. And, of course, the German situation wasn't all that favorable either, but the Germans won quickly by taking advantage of a number of factors the Allies didn't pay much attention to. See, warfare had changed since 1918, and the Germans were aware of the changes, and most of the Allied officers and troops weren't. That meant that the Germans could do things the Allied troops couldn't, and the Germans were able to take advantage of motorized units. Now, that was a key element in the rapidity of the German victory. They massed over a dozen motorized divisions, most of them panzer units, in one place and literally punched a hole through the Allied line. This allowed them to reach the channel and split the Allied forces. Motorization made all this possible, but they also had to have an effective use of motorized units to make it all happen. The Germans had a much better trained army. This had been the case since the previous century and was no different in 1940. Germans had the best trained troops in 1918, even though they were defeated. Now, they were defeated politically, not militarily. In the next 20 years, they developed even better training methods. Not as quickly as with their masses of panzers, but a German infantry division could generally quickly win in a one-to-one battle with an Allied division. And even without several of their other advantages, the Germans could still have won because of their better trained army. Now, the German weapons weren't always superior, but they were always used more effectively than those of the Allies. The most glaring example was the tanks used by both sides. Allies had more tanks, and the Allied tanks generally had thicker armor and larger guns. But quantity and quality are less important than how you used them. Allied tanks were organized into only a few tank divisions that were not used together, with the rest of the vehicles being in separate tank battalions that were scattered all over the place. This was classic 1918 thinking, and the Allies' 1940 tank doctrine was based on it. The Germans organized their tanks into 10 panzer divisions, each of which had about 300 tanks. And then they used these divisions in panzer armies. And when faced with several German panzer divisions, over 1,000 tanks, individual Allied divisions were literally blown apart. And the Germans made better use of aircraft. They had more, and they were better quality than the Allied planes, artillery, and even machine guns. And better preparation was made by the Germans. Not only were the troops well-trained, but so were the senior officers. And they insisted on careful preparation for the 1940 campaign. Germans also understood the need for better communication. They used a lot more radios on the front line. For example, all German tanks had radios. Many Allied tanks didn't. A practice the Russians continued until the end of the war. German commanders were trained to take advantage of all these radios, and as a result, were more in touch with rapidly changing situations than were their Allied counterparts. In one of the most those sublime ironies, the next nation achieved victories of the type the Germans pulled off in 1940 were the Israelis. 1948, 56, and 67, they fought outnumbered and won. They also did it with inferior weapons, but with superior training and preparation. The one time they stumbled was in 1973 when their weapons were better, but their attitudes weren't. A year after the Germans conquered France in a six-week campaign, they invaded Russia. Interestingly, the Germans' casualty experience in the first 6 weeks of each campaign was remarkably similar. In France, they used 122 divisions. In Russia, they used 134 divisions. In France, the Germans lost 155,000 soldiers. In Russia, 213,000. Enemy divisions, 140 in France and 183 in Russia. And losses per enemy division, 1,107 in France and 1,160 in Russia. The big difference was that after Germany had been in France 6 weeks, their opponents were defeated. At that point, the Allies had suffered over 500,000 casualties, and that's dead, prisoners, and missing, and were no longer capable of resisting. The Germans won, hands down. Now, Russia was a bit different. In 6 weeks, the Germans inflicted nearly 1 million casualties on the Russians. By the end of 1941, the Russians would suffer over 4 million casualties. But Russia was a lot bigger than France, had four times the population. They kept on fighting. Blitzkrieg worked in Russia, but it wasn't successful as it was in France. Now, German General Erwin Rommel was the famous Desert Fox and commander of a force occupying France when D-Day arrived in June of 44. But there was another General Rommel in World War II, and this one served Poland as an army commander. In fact, the Polish Major General Juliusz Rommel commanded the forces in Warsaw as the Poles made their last stand against the invading Germans in the second week of September 1939. The two Rommels aren't known to have been related, although there may have been a connection in the distant past. The German Rommel was from a non-aristocratic family in Swabia, a poor area that experienced much immigration to America and other parts of Europe over the centuries. By the time World War II ended, Polish military units had served with four nations, Poland, France, Great Britain, and Russia. When Poland was invaded, first by Germany and then by Russia in September of 1939, the Polish armed forces were soundly defeated. But they weren't destroyed. Of the 800,000 Polish troops on duty in 1939, 35,000 promptly fled to Hungary, 32,000 in Romania and 12,000 in Lithuania after their defeat. Nearly all the Air Force troops, about 9,000, escaped, most of them reaching France by early 40. Three destroyers and several smaller warships of the Polish Navy escaped to Great Britain and promptly began serving with the Royal Navy. By early 1940, over 100,000 Polish troops had found their way to France. The French planned to organize a Polish army of 72,000 men. Nearly all the personnel of the Polish 10th Mechanized Brigade had escaped there and were reformed with French equipment. Meanwhile, the Germans invaded May 10th. On May 30th, the reformed Polish 10th Mechanized Brigade arrived in Paris, where it received some armored vehicles. That unit was later heavily engaged in the vicinity of Paris. Two infantry divisions, the 1st Grenadiers and the 2nd Light, were hastily put together. The 1st Grenadiers was destroyed, managed the Maginot Line, and the 2nd Light escaped into Switzerland. Two more infantry divisions, the 3rd and the 4th, were still forming when the campaign in France ended. A brigade of mountain troops had been formed as well and was sent to Norway in response to the German invasion there. Over 900 Polish pilots found their way to France and 150 able to join various Polish squadrons, flying French aircraft, of course. Many of the remaining went on to Great Britain, joined the Royal Air Force. Polish pilots that went to Great Britain did somewhat better than their compatriots in the French Air Force. 5 fighter and 2 bomber squadrons were formed with Polish pilots in time to participate in the Battle of Britain during the summer of 1940. By the end of the year, there were 8 Polish fighter and 4 bomber squadrons in the Royal Air Force. Overall, the Polish pilots shot down more German aircraft per squadron than any others in British service. They were getting a little bit of theirs back, I suspect. By late 1940, 17,000 Polish troops had made their way to Great Britain, where the Polish government in exile had set up shop. These troops were formed into an armored division, the Polish Armored Corps. Several thousand Poles had found their way to French-controlled Syria in 1940 and were formed into an infantry brigade, the Carpathian Brigade, as they were called. When France fell in the summer of 40, the brigade moved to Palestine and went into British service. Unit fought in North Africa and eventually served as the cadre for the Polish Corps that was formed in late 1942. Now, this unit was raised from the 115,000 Polish refugees that the Russians allowed to exit via Iran, who then traveled to North Africa. About 70,000 of those were forming into a Polish army within Russia in early 1942, but the Soviets decided the group wasn't sufficiently pro-communist and agreed to let the British have them. By the summer of 43, the British equipped Polish 2nd Corps, 3rd Infantry Division, 4th Infantry Division, 2nd Armored Division, and Corps troops went into action during the Battle for Italy. Poles fought there until the end of the war. Back in Great Britain, the Polish Armored Corps became the 1st Armored Division. In addition, the Polish Parachute Brigade was formed. In August of 44, the 1st Armored Division went to France and played a key role in trapping large numbers of German troops after the Allied breakout. This division fought alongside the British as the Allies advanced into Germany. Now, there's not been much in history written about the Polish activity after the fall of Poland, but apparently there was quite a bit. Back in Russia, Stalin had second thoughts about forming a Polish army. In early 43, the Kosciuszko Division was formed. Stalin was responding to the growth of the home army inside Poland. This partisan force, though it lacked heavy weapons, was controlled by the non-communist London-based Polish government in exile. Stalin wanted a communist government in Poland after the war, and he would form his own Polish army to further that goal. By late 43, the 1st Polish Army was formed in Russia, had 44,000 Polish troops. But the officers were Russian, usually Polish-speaking and often of Polish extraction. Even in World War II, politics reared its ugly head and resulted in a lot of casualties that didn't have to happen, just like we're seeing politics raising its head right now. By 1944, the Home Army had 384,000 partisan fighters. Summer of that year, the Russians upped the ante and formed their own communist government in exile for Poland. When the advancing Soviet armies crossed the old Polish border in July of 44, they claimed that their Polish government exile was now in charge of the country. At the same time, the Germans were evacuating nearby Warsaw. The Polish government in London ordered its 48,000 partisans in the area to take over Warsaw. By then, the advancing Soviet armies halted right outside the city, claiming logistical problems. Now, that was a common situation with the Russians, and they said it forced them to wait for supplies to be brought up. Now, this halt was viewed with some cynicism by the Poles, but the Russians did have a good case. Having just completed a long march, fighting all the way, the Russians were not in any shape to go right into city fighting. City fighting is vicious. The Russians weren't sure the Germans just going to abandon Warsaw. When the Germans noted the Russian armies had stopped, their evacuation of Warsaw was halted, and combat units returned to fight the home army troops. Now, the home army held out until early October, getting aid from Allied airdrops flying out of Italy and from the attempts by the Russian-controlled Poles to fight their way into Warsaw. Soviets opened a major winter offensive in January, and this allowed the 1st Polish Army and its Russian officers to enter the city on January 17th. With Poland now largely under Russian control, more Poles were put in uniform. Eventually, there were two Polish armies containing a 500,000 troops led by 14,000 Russian officers. When the war ended, these troops were quickly demobilized and a smaller, more communist army was formed. Many of the Poles who served in the West stayed there after the war. By 1952, Poland was completely under the control of the communists and would stay that way until 1989. Now, there was understandably great bitterness among the Poles about how they were treated during and after the war. The Russians had stabbed them in the back in 1939 and conspired to impose communism on them after the war. Poland, the immediate cause of World War II, suffered more than any other nation in that conflict. About 20% of the population was killed, and its economy was devastated. But in 6 years of hard fighting under Polish, French, British, and Russian colors, they managed to get the Germans out. It only took another 44 years to get the Russians out. You know, enemy action accounted for only 25% of the tanks lost by the British Army in France in 40. All the rest were due to mechanical breakdown. On the other hand, this was a better record than that of the French tanks, nearly half of which had to be abandoned for lack of fuel. French Army policy limited them to only 5 hours supply at a time. And if the battle went on for 6 hours, either you got the crew out to push the tank or you abandoned the sucker. The fall of Poland was brutally swift and rather shocking to the world. Then the war settled into a remarkably dull routine. Save at sea, there was little action and the term phony war began to be heard. Of course, all that changed with a brutality and speed comparable to that seen in Poland when Hitler unleashed his armies in the West in the spring of 40. There are considerable differences between the armies that fought during the phony war period, as can be seen by a comparison of the structure and strength of these divisions. The Polish Infantry Division was a largely infantry outfit, as were the comparable German and French infantry divisions. Capable enough in a traditional style campaign, it couldn't keep up with the speed of a mechanized war. The results of the Polish campaign led all armies to make some changes in their army division tables of organization. The British and French in an attempt to emulate the Germans, and the Germans in order to further refine their techniques. One important change instituted by the German army was to take three light divisions, sort of motorized cab formations, and convert them into light armored divisions through the addition of panzer regiment of three battalions. In practice, of course, none of the German armored divisions actually conformed rigidly to that pattern. And omitted from the table are a number of formations, most notably cavalry divisions, of which the Germans had one with horses and the French had several horse mechanized ones, as well as the German Motorized Cavalry Division that served in Poland, but were thereafter converted to panzers, and the French what they call fortress divisions. Since armored divisions are best at attacking, while infantry divisions are best at defending, the figures are not strictly comparable, except insofar as it was usually German armored divisions doing the attacking and the Allied ones doing the defending. When the Germans undertook their spectacular offensive against France, Belgium, and the Netherlands in May of 40, they were actually taking on enemies who collectively were their superiors in many material measures of military power. The Belgians had 21 infantry divisions, 2 cavalry. The British had 1 armored, 15 motorized. The Dutch had 1 motorized and 8 infantry. The French had 6 armored, 7 motorized, 84 infantry, and 5 cavalry. The Polish had 2 infantry divisions. All the Allies had 7 armored divisions versus the Germans 10. They had 23 motorized versus the Germans 7. They had 115 infantry versus 118 with the Germans. They had 7 cavalry versus 1 with the Germans. So it was 152 for the Allies and 136 with the Germans, and the Allies still lost. Now, these figures are for complete divisions active in France and adjacent areas as the onset of the German offensive. On May 10th, there were about 140 Allied and 122 German divisions in the combat area, which omitted several divisions still in Great Britain, Germany, North Africa, and elsewhere. And there were some independent brigades. The Belgians had 5, the British 5, Czechoslovakia 2, the French 4, the Dutch 2, and the Polish 1, and the Germans 3. And the French figures include 5 fortress divisions, specialized for duty in fortified defensive areas. So they didn't have any organic transport or heavy artillery. It was against one of these that the weight of the German offensive in Sedan first fell. It having been deployed to an unfortified sector, like a fish out of water. Surprisingly, in many ways, the Germans were very inferior to the Allies in tanks. They only had 3,227 tanks as opposed to 590 British and 3,437 French. That gave the Allies an advantage of 25%. But sheer number of tanks wasn't necessarily the critical factor. The real issue was quality. Tanks in Class 1 were fast, agile vehicles capable of making at least 25 miles an hour. Class 2 could do no better than about 18. Class 3 were able to do about 12, and that had to be on the roads. So while the Allies had 25% more tanks, less than a third of their tanks were as nimble as the entire German tank pack. Now, this advantage of agility had both tactical and strategic benefits. Tactically, German tanks could maneuver with greater speed. Even a Panzer I that had 2 machine guns and barely a half inch of armor, but with a 25-mile-per-hour road speed, could elude the heavily armed French Char B1, had a 75-millimeter and a 47-millimeter cannon, machine guns, and 3 inches of armor. But it could only do 18 miles per hour on the road. I mean, the Germans could run rings around them, and they did. And virtually all the German tanks were concentrated in their panzer divisions. In contrast, the Allies dispersed their tanks. The French put most of their Class 3 tanks and about 300 Class 2 tanks in 33 separate tank battalions, signed to support infantry divisions on the front. As a result, their armored divisions that were neither doctrinally nor organizationally uniform shared about 700 Class 2 vehicles, most of the Class 1 vehicles. That's about 220 that were sent to 5 semi-mechanized cavalry divisions. The Germans were a genius at concentrating the assets they had and using them to the best effectiveness. Now, the Germans had 10 panzer divisions for their 1940 campaign, and no two of these divisions were organized in the same way. In this case, the Germans were simply being practical. They're still sorting out the details of armored warfare. They were blazing the trail for everybody else. From their experience in the September 1939 campaign, where they used 6 panzer divisions, they raised more for the May 1940 campaign in France. And the unique organization of the 10 divisions was kind of a blueprint they used for everything they did. In addition to the 10 panzer divisions, the German raised 7 motorized infantry divisions. They were called Panzer Grenadier. Actually, there weren't 7 of these divisions, but rather independent regiments and brigades that equaled 7 divisions. And these units were as eclectic in their organization as the panzer divisions. Germans actually had a standard armored division organization in 1938 that was made up of 266 tanks and 4 tank battalions, plus four infantry battalions, four artillery battalions, a recon battalion, an engineer battalion, and the usual support units. And then there was a light division of 200 tanks and three tank battalions with five infantry divisions and otherwise like the armored division. Well, created all the organizational eclecticism was the rush to organize new divisions and the widely different interpretations of what an armored division should look like. Since an armored division didn't experience combat until 1939, the German high command allowed the many different ideas to express themselves. They were looking for practicality. By 1941, with two armored campaigns under their belt, the Germans had adopted a more uniform organization for their panzer divisions. They added more infantry and artillery and cut the number of tanks in half and increased the number of divisions to 21. They also increased the number of divisions, the number of panzer grenadier divisions to 16. So with only 37 motorized divisions and 97 infantry divisions with horse-drawn transport, the Germans invaded Russia, which may have been a mistake. Had they not invaded Russia and waited for Stalin to attack, and he was going to, they might have won the war. In late 1940, the Polish army is reconstituted in Great Britain. Now, this was the second time the Polish army had been reconstituted, the first being in late 39 and early 1940, when several Polish units were raised in France as a planned corps of four divisions. The manpower consisted of Poles who had been working abroad at the time of the German and Soviet conquest of their homeland in September and October of 39, and of men who had escaped from that debacle by way of Romania and Lithuania. These divisions had gone down in defeat with the collapse of France in May and June of 1940. As a result, when it came time to recreate the Polish army in Great Britain, there were severe manpower problems. But enough men were soon collected together. There were pre-war expatriates who'd been unable or unwilling to go to France before her fall. They'd been engaged in specialized training in Great Britain at the time of the fall of France, and they managed to escape the French debacle, whether at Dunkirk or as the Germans imposed their occupation regime through Spain or by some other means. The two latter groups, of course, were men with some military experience, so could provide a cadre for the creation of larger units. As the new army is being formed, it transpired that there were too many officers and too few enlisted men. And there were reasons for this. The men who were training in Great Britain at the time of the fall of France were mostly officers. And those who were motivated to escape from German-occupied France were mostly officers as well. Now, there was no way to compel or employ most of these officers in their proper ranks, nor was it possible to reduce them in rank, a matter that would not only have been disastrous for morale, but was contrary to Polish military law. So eventually they came up with a very novel solution, units consisting entirely of officers. Now, the all-officer units were organized precisely as were the regular units. So a company conformed to the standard table of organization established for its particular arm of service, save that instead of privates, there were lieutenants. Instead of non-commissioned officers, there were captains. Instead of lieutenants, there were majors. Instead of a captain, there was a lieutenant colonel or a colonel. Now, the new units had some problems since officers had different privileges, rights, and obligations than enlisted men, but they worked moderately well. Although this expedient may seem at first glance to have been rather silly, it was by no means a bad solution. It preserved the military skills of the officers in question, skills that would eventually be needed if the manpower problem could be resolved. And this actually proved to be the case. As time went on, an increasing number of expatriate Poles, including many from the United States, made their way to Great Britain to enlist. And after Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, the Russians were eventually persuaded to release tens of thousands of Polish prisoners of war, mostly enlisted men, since Stalin had massacred the bulk of the Polish officers that had fallen into his hands in 1939. He saw them as potentially a problem, so he dealt with the problem by just simply having them shot. As a result, the Polish army in exile eventually rose to the equivalent of about a half dozen divisions. And Polish forces proved among the most effective in the Allied armies, serving with particular distinction in Italy, where it was Polish troops who made the final assault on Monte Cassino. So in the end, the Polish improvisation of officer-only companies proved a useful expedient. And frankly, the Poles were not the only ones to have all officer units. The Russians did this on purpose when they needed units that were of unquestioned reliability and competence. When the Soviets introduced mass conscription after World War I, prior to that, conscription had been very selective. They found themselves with a lot of well-trained officers, not many NCOs, and a lot of, well, let's call them indifferent troops. Their occasional expedient for this situation was to form units made up solely of officers. And this continued after the war, whenever they needed a unit that had just had to get it right the first time. And they did that right up until the 1980s. You know, it was Winston Churchill described the Battle of Britain. He said, "Never have so many owed so much to so few." The few he was talking about referred to the relatively handful of fighter pilots in whose hands the fate of freedom rested for several critical weeks during the summer of 1940. Having overrun France in 43 days, Hitler was seeking ways to bring his already successful war to a glorious end by forcing Great Britain to sue for peace. But the British refused to quit, so Hitler decided he had to invade Great Britain. Now, the invasion of Britain, called Operation Sea Lion, entailed three battles. Number one, the Royal Air Force, to gain control of the air. Had Goring been able to do that, we'd all be speaking German now. Two, with the Royal Navy to ensure command of the Channel, and with the British Army and the Home Guard, and that would put the end to the British Empire. Well, as history records, Hitler was not able to do any of the three. Now, the Battle of Britain was the first strategically important air battle in history. And although the dates are somewhat arbitrary, from July 10th through October 31st, 1940, as Great Britain stood alone, Hitler unleashed his henchman, Reich Marshal Hermann Göring's Air Force. In the end, the Royal Air Force triumphed over the Luftwaffe. On the British side, the battle was fought by fewer than 1,000 fighter pilots. That was Churchill's few. During the nearly 3 months of air combat, the British lost 900 fighters and a handful of bombers, and the Germans over 1,700 aircraft of all type. Now, there were a number of reasons for the British victory, according to historians. First, Hitler and Göring kept changing their objectives. At first, they attempted to lure the RAF into a one-sided air combat by means of aggressive patrols. Then they shifted to massive attacks on forward airfields, which were mostly of little strategic importance. Suddenly realizing that British radar defenses might be vulnerable, the Luftwaffe for a time attempted to knock out the chain home system with only marginal success. Then they concentrated on the main airfields and fighter production facilities. And just as this strategy was starting to hurt the RAF severely, luck intervened. In retaliation for an accidental German bombing raid on London, Churchill ordered the RAF Bomber Command to hit Berlin. And although the damage was slight, Göring, who had once said, "If Berlin is bombed, my name is Meyer," generally guarded as a Jewish name in German, with Hitler's permission, shifted the weight of the Luftwaffe to the terror bombing of London. And although the destruction was great, it was by no means unbearable. For every bomb that fell on London, that was one that didn't fall on the factories, turning out Hurricanes and Spitfires. Had they concentrated on the factories and literally cut off the supply of planes to the RAF, history would have been quite a bit different. And although German bombers could reach most of Great Britain, they were forced to do so beyond the range of fighter and escort. So the critical battle against the RAF Fighter Command was fought in a relatively small area over southeastern England. Damaged British planes were frequently able to make emergency landings on roads and beaches and farms, while damaged German planes had to attempt a long flight back across the Channel to their bases in France and Belgium. And a British pilot who bailed out landed on British soil and soon returned to service. It wasn't unusual for an RAF pilot to be shot down in the morning and be back in the air in the afternoon. Downed German pilots became prisoners of war. And although the Luftwaffe began the Battle of Britain with more airplanes, the British were producing them at a faster rate. Between July and October, the Germans produced between 750 and 800 single-seat fighters, while the British produced about 1,900, more than twice as many. At the start of the war, both air forces used 87-octane fuel, but shortly before the formal beginning of the Battle of Britain, the RAF began to use 100-octane fuel, a richer mixture that greatly enhanced the performance of Hurricanes and Spitfires by about 25%. And this, coupled with some other technical improvements, such as constant-speed propellers, led to somewhat higher speed and a better, much better rate of climb. As both airplanes were already operationally equal to, or in the Spitfire's case, superior to, the standard German fighter, the Messerschmitt Bf 109, this was a significant operational advantage. And although Germany had overrun France and northeastern Europe rather swiftly in the spring of 1940, its victory was by no means one-sided. Luftwaffe had committed about 1,000 first-line fighters to the campaign, while the Allies between them had nearly as many. Allied losses were heavy, including aircraft abandoned during the Allied retreat. They lost 65 Spitfires, 350 Hurricanes, and 300 Dewantine 520s, well, a very good French fighter, just coming off the assembly line during the battle. But the Luftwaffe also lost 500 Messerschmitt fighters and a lot of bombers. Pilot losses on both sides had been serious. And in an inspired moment, the RAF shipped German pilot prisoners to Great Britain, so they removed them from the war permanently. Had they not done that? Now, any one of these factors, had they been decided differently, could have had a major impact on the war. By the onset of the Battle of Britain, a series of rather conspicuous towers had been erected. It provided considerable warning as to the onset of major German air raids. Coupled with a sophisticated, centralized fighter direction system, this permitted the fighter command to make maximum effective use of its resources and allowed for a more reasoned response to attacks. And although the Germans for a time attempted to knock out the chain home system, they were only marginally successful, and weren't even aware of that because of effective British deception measures. The Brits were sneaky, no question about it. So the British won the Battle of Britain. Barely. Despite all their advantages, it still came down to, as Air Marshal Hugh Dowding of the Fighter Command said, British young men, aided by some Canadians, Poles, Czechs, and Frenchmen, who had a special fervor their British comrades couldn't match, shooting down German young men in greater numbers than the latter could shoot down the former. As a result of the Battle of Britain, Hitler was forced to cancel Operation Sea Lion, in which neither his army nor his navy had much confidence anyway. He then had to find another way to win the war, so it was a search that led directly to Russia on June 22, 1941. The grandson of Alfred Dreyfus, the French Jewish staff officer whose conviction on a trumped-up espionage charge became a cause célèbre in the 1890s, died fighting for France and the RAF during the Battle of Britain. Among other persons unwelcome in France who nevertheless served were the Count of Paris, the Bourbon claimant to the throne, and Prince Bonaparte, the heir to Napoleon. Legally barred from French soil, both served with considerable distinction in the Foreign Legion. One of the most feared German weapons of the war was the 88. Now, initially, the 88mm gun was an anti-aircraft weapon. This caliber was used for no other type of artillery. The Germans, in a manner that permeated all their military planning and operations, had foreseen the possibility of anti-aircraft guns having to confront tanks. So they equipped the 88s with suitable sights for firing at ground targets and gave them a supply of armor-piercing shells. Despite popular belief, the Germans first used 88s against tanks in North Africa. The first was during May of 1940. A British armored counterattack against the Germans prompted the German commander to order up the 88s, and this action promptly smashed the British attack. General Erwin Rommel is given credit for using the 88s in North Africa, and it was Rommel who ordered the 88s into action early in the Battle of France. Rommel was probably the best commander the Germans had, and Hitler forced him to commit suicide. The British had a weapon similar to the 88, as did most armies. The U.S. had 90mm anti-aircraft guns, but the British 94mm anti-aircraft gun was equipped solely to fire at aircraft. British officers and crews were trained to do nothing else. The Germans were trained to be flexible. and their equipment was designed to facilitate this. And contrary to long popular opinion, it wasn't the Germans who were the thick-headed do-it-by-the-book types. This attitude was much more common on the Allied side, with the British and Soviets being more prone to this type of thinking than anybody else. And by the way, the British did have an 88, as their famous 25-pounder field gun was actually an 88-millimeter howitzer. During his campaigns in North Africa in 1941 through 43, Rommel carried with him a well-worn copy of the German translation of Generals and Generalship, written by Sir Archibald Wavell, one of his opponents. During the early part of the Second World War, Hitler's private railroad train was named America. Among the inherent casualties of the Second World War has to be numbered the approximately 40 pedestrians who were struck by automobiles nightly in blacked-out London during the Blitz. As the United States rearmed in 1940, the spectacle of the dreaded German panzers made it clear it had to be a powerful tank to confront the Nazis. The tank had to have thick armor and a powerful gun. And tank designers immediately ran into problems. European tanks had their turrets and chassis armor cast in large pieces. There was no U.S. foundry that could do the casting of that size and quantity. So the tank designers improvised. The M3, or Grant tank, had a 37-millimeter gun and a small turret and a larger 75-millimeter gun mounted in the body of the tank. And the armor was riveted together. Put into production in 1941, many were sent as lend-lease material to the British troops in North Africa. And there the Allied troops appreciated the firepower of the 75-millimeter gun, even if you had to turn the tank to turn the gun, but noted the riveted armor tended to be lethal even if it hit with a shell that didn't penetrate. Rivets would pop off and kill the crew inside. And the Grant was too high, making an easy target for the enemy. The forging problem was soon solved. A more conventional design, the M4 Sherman tank, was put into mass production in 1944. Certainly, it was the manufacturing ability of American industry that actually won the war. Now, if there was any one theater of World War II that was truly hell on earth, it was Russia, the Eastern Front. This is where most of the troops were and where most of the troops died. And here was the scene of the biggest battles, the grandest victories, the most dismal defeats. All by itself, the war in Russia killed more people than all of World War I. The war in Russia was different, not least of which because non-Russians failed to realize how big and important a Russian front was. A case can be made the Soviets defeated the Germans in World War II pretty much single-handedly. And that's been the Soviet position all along. The number of troops involved and the subsequent casualties supports the Soviet position. The Germans lost 2.2 million soldiers on the Eastern Front, and the Soviets lost 12 million. As total German losses in the war were 3.7 million, most of the losses were inflicted by the Soviets. Of course, without the Western allies, there'd have been a lot more Germans in the Soviet Union, a lot more dead Soviets, and the possibility of a Soviet defeat. 1944, only 40% of the German army was in the Soviet Union because the Allies had invaded France and were advancing on Germany itself. More German troops were also tied down in Italy in occupation duty throughout Europe. Soviets have always insisted they defeated Germany. Without the German invasion of Russia in 41, the Germans could have taken Great Britain and the Middle East. Of course, this is one of the great what-if situations of history. What prevented the originally planned German invasion of Great Britain in late 40 was their inability to overcome the Royal Air Force. Even had they accomplished this, there was still the Royal Navy to deal with. And like Napoleon, the Germans had a larger army than the British but couldn't get the means to cross the Channel. We're going to talk more about this, but for now, we've run out of time for tonight. So until tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.